Welcome to Open Minds Radio with Alejandro Rojas. Open Minds Radio is your UFO news authority, presenting evidence and the latest news regarding the UFO phenomenon. Here's your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Thank you, Mr. Bob Dean. This is Alejandro Rojas with Open Minds Radio, the fourth most popular radio program out of all of them on Blog Talk. That's what we use to broadcast our podcast. Fourth out of something like over 40,000 shows. And I know I make up large numbers all the time, but it is really 40,000. If I was being silly and making it up, I would have said we were fourth out of 16 trillion. And if Blog Talk had 16 trillion radio programs, we probably still would be fourth because we are that good. Thank you for joining us. And we're only that good because of all of our wonderful listeners, because they're so inspiring, all the nice notes that you guys send us and everything. I'm very, very happy that you guys like the show. And we do this for you to get the information out. And we have an incredible guest today with just a ton of information, and that is James Mosley. Maybe some of you haven't heard of him, but he's actually been into UFOs for decades and decades and decades. At the beginning of our interview, I asked him about 1947, and he was around then when all of this started. And he says, well, I'm not wasn't a ufologist then, which he wasn't, but he was around and to hear the stories, and that in itself is pretty astonishing. I think, you know, there's not many people who can tell you, oh yeah, I remember when Kenneth Arnold saw those UFOs. So very interesting guy. He started a magazine in the 50s with some friends called Saucer News, which is was kind of more along the lines of Open Minds, very serious and everything. But we'll talk about his evolution and how he evolved into, in the late 70s, to start up his own kind of newsletter called Saucer Smear. And Saucer Smear, he's one of these guys. There's only like one other person. Well, no, there's a couple other people. Nancy Talbot's kind of like this. She's more online, but Dr. Leo Sprinkle, who we've had on the show, one of the original, he's been around for decades, one of the original abduction researchers, a psychologist, he isn't online at all. You know, they never made the switch to the internet and to computers, and that's the same with James Mosley. So if you want to get Saucer Smear, you actually have to send him, you know, a check or a love donation, he calls it, sarcastically. You'll see he's kind of a funny guy. And he'll send you his newsletter that's printed out. He types it out, prints it, and sends it to you. So it is old school. So we'll talk to Mosley about the years and years of UFOs, and mostly around the 50s and what it was like back then and how he got started and how he got started with Saucer Smear. So that's coming up. Very exciting. He's a great guy, and it's invaluable to be able to talk to these people who were around back then, because there's not many left, and they, unfortunately, lots of the people he refers to that he works with, his colleagues, for instance, are not around anymore. A couple of notes. Our last guest, Mr. Greg Bishop from UFOmystic.com. A great interview. It was really fun talking about Benowitz and Dulce and all of that stuff. He's going to be at a conference that is actually being held, put on by Nario Hayakawa, who used to run a conference in Dulce, but now he's moved it to Albuquerque, which is a wise move because Albuquerque is a bigger place. And I love New Mexico. I like talking about Albuquerque because I miss it. Incredible food, if you like Mexican food. Amazing stuff at all the restaurants here. Anyways, his conference is called Wake Up Now. It's kind of more of a conspiracy UFO type thing. But Greg Bishop is going to be there, and you can find out more about that at wakeupnowconference.com. And I don't think, we don't have any Open Minds people speaking there. Forget what I just said. Just kidding. It should be good. We're going to have people actually there selling some stuff if you want to buy some T-shirts and stuff, and you're going to be there. Also, some bad news, Contact in the Desert. I was going to be out there talking about contactees and Giant Rock, which is some of what James Mosley's going to be talking about. Some of the stuff from the 50s that was kind of fun. But unfortunately, alas, the contact in the desert is no longer. Unfortunately, some of the people organizing it had some personal things come up, and they're not going to be able to put that on anymore. That was going to be held by MUFON LA. However, we still have in Fresno the MUFON Symposium coming up in July, so that'll be a lot of fun.
Irvine.
Oh, I said Fresno. Irvine. And then finally, who was that? Did you hear that noise that said Irvine? We'll see if we can figure that out in a little bit. The third conference, the conference that I was going to go talk at gets canceled, but the conference that Antonio and Michael are going to go talk at has not been canceled yet. Hopefully it won't be. But that is the Arizona UFO Sightings First Annual Kingman Conference. So we haven't talked a whole lot about that, but there are rumors. We've talked about the Frank Scully book quite a bit. And, in fact, James Mosley here, again, we talk about Frank Scully because a lot of the crashes that supposedly haven't happened came from Frank Scully's book, including the Kingman crash. So supposedly there's a UFO crash back then, and now they've started up the first annual Kingman Conference. That's going to be May 6th through the 9th. Antonio Juneas and Michael Schratt of Open Minds will be there. And you can find out more about that at ArizonaUFOSightings.com. ArizonaUFOSightings.com. You know, another thing that you're going to find, you'll find some information on some of this stuff at our website, but more importantly and more exciting, you're going to find news, the daily UFO headlines, because there are UFOs in the news all over the world all the time, and we have a specialist who stays on top of this stuff every day. This guy is a flipping genius. That is the little voice that we heard a little while ago, which is Jason McClellan. Jason, are you here?
I am, Mr. Alejandro. Greetings and hello, everyone. This is your Open Minds News Brief for Monday, April 25th, 2011. A recent video shows what appeared to be a dead extraterrestrial partially buried in the Siberian snow. Two people walking near Irkutsk, Russia, allegedly noticed the body and recorded it with a video camera. According to the Daily Mail, one of the witnesses stated, "We couldn't believe it when we saw it." The Daily Mail also pointed out that the area surrounding the location of this body is a UFO hotspot where dozens of sightings are reported every year. The Telegraph, the Daily Mail, and other media outlets were sure to point out that many had dismissed the dead alien video as an elaborate hoax from the very start. But in response to the video, the Los Angeles Times, and I have to give the Times credit here, they don't usually respond. The most of the mainstream media jumps on these videos and they're not very careful with holding back their excitement. But the Los Angeles Times actually carefully and wisely stated, "We cannot confirm any of these claims that this is real. It may very well be a hoax. However, it is important to note that more than 1 million people have watched the video on YouTube. Real or not, people are watching." And that's what the Los Angeles Times said. But last week, news reports emerged announcing that two teen boys did, in fact, create the alien in the video. A spokesman from the Russian Interior Ministry confirmed that they had found the body in the house of one of the boys. And as the spokesman described, it was lying under his bed. An examination of it revealed it had been made of breadcrumbs, which are covered in chicken skin.
Oh, and you have a picture there. I've never seen that picture.
Nasty.
Yeah, that's gross.
Somebody's leftover dinner.
Well, and I think I heard a story where the cops, because someone said they thought it might be a baby.
Right.
Like a dead baby. So the cops went over and said, "Hey, you guys got a dead baby here?" And they freaked. They're like, "Oh, no, it's not a baby. It's a chicken."
Yeah, that's why the cops were even looking into it.
Mm-hmm.
They were sort of door to door and found these teen boys. Hoaxers.
Yay.
It looked kind of weird, and you see that not frequently, but the chicken skin has been used before. It's kind of veiny and slimy and gross.
In the whole cryptozoological realm, lots of dead animal parts and bones are used to say that they're cryptozoological animals.
Right. Yeah, and who knows why people do this. I don't know why these boys did it, but
to get a million hits.
Well, yeah, but I don't know what that's going to do for them in Siberia. There's not a whole lot going on in Siberia, but
you can tell people how cool you are. You got a million hits. Well, and it does it. Actually, with their channel, anything they're going to post is going to get hundreds of thousands of hits probably from here on out.
Yeah.
unless they are really stupid and it'll die off. But at least they've got some YouTube power right now. I hope they use it wisely.
Well, shame on them.
Yep.
Shame on them.
For shame, you little sons of guns.
Don't like those hoaxers.
Yeah, come on.
In other news, a professor from the University of Missouri-Columbia wants Congress to look into the UFO issue. According to AOL News, Bill Wickersham has called for open, secrecy-free U.S. congressional hearings on the UFO-ET matter. To support his request, the adjunct professor of peace studies cites the 1999 Cometa Report. A 13-member committee in France, made up of retired generals, scientists, and space experts, created this report, which studied 500 UFO sightings from around the world. And this report concluded that some of the UFO cases possibly had otherworldly sources. But given the current political climate, Wickersham told AOL News that he does not think a congressional hearing on UFOs has much of a chance of happening right now. He went on to say, and what's more, look at what happened to Dennis Kucinich. The giggle factor, the ridicule, the ignorance, the apathy, denial, all these things that surround this issue. It takes a lot of guts for a politician to speak out on UFOs. Most politicians run from it.
Yep.
And they do.
Mm-hmm. They run far and fast.
So I don't know how much of a chance we have of a U.S. congressional hearing on UFOs anytime soon, but
if something big happens, who was it? Oh, it's looking at stuff at Dan Aykroyd. Dan Aykroyd's like, you know, one of these days a UFO is going to fly over a stadium or something, and then these guys will not be able to ignore it. And I think he's right.
Right. And we are having bigger stories. I mean, they're not necessarily any bigger than what has happened in the past, but they're getting a lot more attention.
Yeah.
The mainstream media is covering a lot of these stories that come out, and it spreads like wildfire.
Not totally ignoring them.
So who knows? You're onto something there. We might have one of these issues that's considered to be a bigger issue that forces people to pay attention.
Yep. It's going to happen.
Hope so. In other news, lots of different stories have been circulating through the media in the past weeks as a result of the FBI launching The Vault on their website. I like saying The Vault.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds menacing. But The Vault makes it easy for people to browse through select FBI files. One story that seemed to be popular last week was John F. Kennedy and his supposed interest in UFOs. A history teacher named William Lester recently wrote a book on the subject called A Celebration of Freedom, JFK and the New Frontier. For the book, Lester referenced previously classified documents he obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests. Two of these documents were allegedly written by Kennedy just 10 days before his assassination, one of which asked the CIA for UFO information.
Yeah.
This got big, big buzz last week, but it's nothing new.
Yeah, these files were not new, and people said they were new when they were not, and they were actually released in the 70s. From the hard work of Bruce McAbee, who was an optical physicist for the Navy, actually, Dr. Bruce McAbee, who got these out in the late 70s or mid-70s. And so they've been out for a while. They're not anything new.
That is correct.
But now they're out again, and now people are saying that, you know, NSA has new documents out, which is not the case either. They're referring to old files. But I don't give a flip about the FBI. I don't give a flip about the NSA. I don't give a flip about anything. Name the band.
Alejandro Rojas.
The Butthole Surfers did that song.
Sorry.
But they said the bad word. They didn't say flip.
That's okay.
As you know, I don't say bad words.
And you changed it for radio.
Yeah. And that's how I sing it, too, because I like to sing that song sometimes for fun, and I use flip.
Good work. But it is interesting, since The Vault, you know, and it seems lately the media is –
yeah.
I don't know. They seem to get excited by conspiracy, and you would think that reputable media outlets wouldn't. But they're latching on to a lot of these stories that are total conspiracy.
And it might be a trend in media because these sensational stories are growing. You have papers like The Sun, which is a complete tabloid, over-sensationalizes everything, is often not accurate, but they're the biggest paper in the U.K., so is American media starting to do that, to sensationalize and become more tabloid to get more ratings? I think so. What are the biggest stories these days? Charlie Sheen, Lindsay Lohan, you know, it's all of this kind of stuff.
The royal wedding.
The royal wedding.
That's the big news right now, and you mentioned The Sun, so I'm thinking about the royal wedding.
Yeah, that reminds me of White Wedding, Billy Idol.
All right, We'll move on, Alejandro. Here's a story, and I don't know what to take from this story. My emotions are being played with here, but we talked about this week after week about how we feel we should go back to the moon. We want to get back to the moon, but all these missions that are brought up are either going to asteroids or trying to get to Mars, putting the moon aside. Well, apparently we are going back to the moon.
Right.
The National Journal reported last week that Congress passed a 2011 spending bill that will allow NASA's Constellation program to move forward with plans for a manned lunar mission. The Orion space capsule that NASA plans to use for the manned lunar mission was unveiled last month. So we'll see. I mean, this is just one report, but supposedly the manned moon mission is back on the charts at least.
Well, I know they were kind of working on it where they're using essentially old stuff, though. So if we go to the moon, what we're going to see is rockets taking up capsules, the same capsules we went to the moon with before. Well, not the same. Shape the same, look the same. They're going to parachute down in the sky and land in the ocean just like before. So we're going old school, which I guess isn't too bad because we weren't done with that and it's cheap or whatever. But yeah, total old school. So they're redoing all of this stuff and hopefully going back to the moon, which makes it just makes sense to make a base on the moon.
Right.
Then go to Mars.
But it is kind of embarrassing for us, and it gives us a bad face to the extraterrestrials on the moon.
Yeah.
Because they're going to see us rolling up in our 1950s car, and they're going to laugh at us.
Well, and they could be upset.
These guys haven't progressed at all.
Yeah. And, you know, you were here, you left, now you're back. We're messing with our emotions.
Yeah. And we're not showing up in anything new and fancy. It's the same old stuff.
Yeah.
Hopefully they've got something new up their sleeve.
Yeah, but you know what? We didn't use that old stuff that was really cool that much.
Right.
Because, I mean, the rover, the moon rover and stuff, that was cool stuff.
Right.
So, man, maybe we'll...
Well, my fingers are crossed. I hope we do go back to the moon. That makes so much sense.
And maybe that makes it even closer to people being able to go to the moon, you know, recreational-wise.
Right.
Because that's becoming such a big deal.
The company that NASA's most likely going to use for that is SpaceX.
Yep.
And the SpaceX rockets.
Yep.
And SpaceX is working to help propel space tourism as well. So we can go there too, my friend, and we'll go there and see what the NASA guys are doing. In other NASA news, NASA scientists recently discovered an underground dry ice lake containing more carbon dioxide than was originally thought to exist. The underground dry ice deposit is roughly the size of Lake Superior. Scientists suspect that some of this carbon dioxide was once in Mars' atmosphere, making it denser. Scientists were able to locate the dry ice lake by using ground-penetrating radar from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter.
Wow.
So they found these dry ice lakes before on Mars, but this one's the biggest.
This is just like the movie that made the guy governor, Schwarzenegger. I think it was because of this movie that's why he's... The one where he goes to Mars and...
Well, you don't know if he actually goes
to Mars. They put those heaters... Oh, yeah, that's in question. They put those heaters in the carbon dioxide lakes...
Right.
...which go into the atmosphere and which changes the atmosphere when his face... He's all... Oh, and his face is going to explode. And luckily, the carbon dioxide got in the sky enough and he saved his life.
I think they're actually remaking that movie, too, which is a shame.
What is the movie?
They're remaking a lot of his movies. I always forget the name of that movie. It's actually
Total Recall.
Yes, Total Recall. They're remaking some of the Conan the Barbarian. You're going back. I don't think you can remake an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff. You do something new, people. Come on.
People are out of ideas. Nobody has an original thought.
I can come up with some good ideas. I always do. Driving to work, I'm always thinking that'd be a great movie and be crazy and fun. And
I am too, but. It's a prerequisite to be in Hollywood. You can't have an original idea.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yep.
But, you know, this whole terraforming the moon type of stuff, it's kind of – it's interesting that, you know, these sci-fi type of things come up in real life.
Mm-hmm.
More chances for life in Mars.
Well, we'll see more of that.
Yep.
Because we are the future, Alejandro.
I think we've
reached the future that was portrayed in those movies.
Whitney Houston said the children are the future and we're the children that have now grown up.
Then she was right.
Yep.
Excellent. Here's something I wanted to bring up. Suzanne Taylor, who we've had as a guest on the show before, she has a movie called What on Earth, received a nice little write-up in the New York Times last week. The movie that explores the crop circle phenomenon premiered on Friday at New York's Quad Cinema, and it's running through this week, till Thursday, I believe.
Yeah, pretty cool. New York Times. I was so shocked. That was wonderful to see that.
Yeah, it's good to see she got it, and it was a, you know.
They were cool about it, too. They weren't making fun of her, the movie.
Right. Yeah, those write-ups are they're supposed to be informational, but most of the time they go into opinion, too, and they kind of.
Especially with UFO stuff. And
absolutely. But they actually did a very nice job with it, and it's cool to see that she's got it running in a theater in New York for a week. So hopefully it's received well. It's a good movie.
Mm-hmm. So. We talk about the movie in our Crop Circle issue and in our last one. Antonio did a review.
That's right.
But that Crop Circle issue we had was phenomenal. It was great.
I liked it.
Pretty
very
pictures.
Visual. Yeah. An Irish astronomer claims to have successfully tracked UFOs as they fly around the Earth. Eamon Ansbrough has researched UFOs for the past 20 years, and not only has he seen UFOs, but through his observations, Ansbrough has concluded that they follow defined flight paths around the Earth. He has a camera array consisting of 11 different cameras set up in his hometown of Boyle that have enabled him to conduct his research. This array monitors the entire sky all day and all night, recording anything that moves. The compilation of data from these cameras is what led Ansbrough to his conclusion that UFOs are circling the Earth. According to IrisCentral.com, Ansbrough explains, "When you take all that data and apply it to this theory, we have found that it fits within the computerized time graphs and that we can predict when future sightings will occur, and we have found that it has happened in Boyle." Ansbrough, who is a member of a group called OSETI, which is the Optical Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, mm-hmm. wants to establish a UFO center in his hometown of Boyle, citing the potential for tourism.
I feel derelict in my duties because I've seen this headline, but I hadn't read the story and checked up on it,
mm-hmm.
and it sounds so interesting, and now that you're talking about it, I feel bad I didn't research it some more. So what do you think, since you've looked into it?
I'm not sure. You know, he's got this camera array. I haven't seen the data, his actual data.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing that pops into my mind would be satellites.
Yeah.
Something following a defined path that's always coming around at the same time.
Yeah. And the hard part is there's no doubt. Well, you know, our country doesn't like to follow established rules.
Right.
So we're going to have satellites wherever we want to have satellites. Nobody's going to stop us. Not that I agree that we don't follow with these rules, but that's kind of the American way, right? So, yeah, he would not know about secret satellites. Not only that, our secret Air Force space plane that was flying
mm-hmm.
around,
yeah.
unmanned thing that we just found out about
right.
as far as the public. So there's a lot of stuff up there, true, that could be ours or other.
However, somebody who's got this huge array, and I don't know what his situation is, but I've seen pictures with him having access, I don't know if they're his, but he has access to some pretty powerful telescopes. He's an astronomer. I would think an astronomer would know the difference
mm-hmm.
between
yeah.
you know, what a satellite looks like and what something unknown
does
looks
he
like.
Providing this footage? Is any of it, I wonder if he's seeing any zinging and zagging and zooming and right turns?
I don't know. I'd like to contact him and find out more information because there wasn't any information provided other than the fact that he's charted all this and been able to figure it out.
We should try to contact him.
Yeah, I think so. Because, again, an astronomer should know what a satellite
we'll try
like
to get him
sky.
On the show, people.
So, you know, he is an astronomer, and he's pretty
mm-hmm.
confident that what he's saying is UFOs, and he's able to track them and predict them.
Right.
So, cool stuff.
Yeah.
In other news related to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the SETI Institute has been scanning the skies for more than 50 years searching for evidence of extraterrestrial life by using radio telescopes. But funding issues have put their search on hold. According to Discovery News, budget cutbacks by two of SETI's key donors, the State of California and the National Science Foundation, have forced the Institute to suspend the operations of its Allen Telescope Array in California. The Allen Telescope Array's operations have been suspended since April 15th, and its future is uncertain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I mentioned, and this is fun because I hope that they printed that San Jose Mercury called, and I got to have some input, and she was shocked by what I said and disappointed because, you know, and I think you might feel the same way. I love the SETI guys. It's great that they're searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. It's wonderful. But the method they're doing it seems to be so silly to me, using technology we use to listen to signals of the type of technology we use when these civilizations probably are, I mean, they're alien by definition, using things that we couldn't conceive. So I think it just, and plus with the evidence, of course, us being UFO investigators, there's evidence that they, there is visitation or something flying around, and they could be doing like this astronomer, helping him out
right.
with his telescopes to take pictures of these things flying around. That's a better use of the money than these telescopes. So,
to be honest, when I first saw this headline that said that, I forget the headline I read, it was something like SETI, I don't remember, but what I thought the article was going to be was that they were stopping or putting a hold on their using radio telescopes, and they were going to focus on something else,
mm-hmm.
on some other method, and I was excited.
Yeah.
But yeah,
right.
And you know they do other things, and they don't just use this Allen telescope array. As far as I know, they do other things. So I don't think SETI is completely on hold.
Yeah.
It's just this array of radio telescopes.
Well, now
here.
They have time because one thing I really like Shostak.
Right.
He's really funny and witty, and he's great to inspire people to get into science. But his debunking gets a little too far, and especially even recently, I read him say. Read him saying UFOs do this and UFO people who see UFOs always say they're doing this or that. He doesn't research that. How would he know? And it's very it's unprofessional of him to make those sorts of claims when he doesn't research. He should research it, and then you know he would be able to say something. I know, for instance, Peter Sturrock, a doctor of astronomy, who he should have read his book, but I've talked to him. He says he hasn't read that book. Come on, that's where you begin as an astronomer researching UFOs. If you're going to talk about UFOs, research them first. So that debunking, I hope his radio show gets taken off the air.
It's a good thing to research.
Yeah, come on.
Well, hopefully things come through for SETI and they use this opportunity to come up with something.
This is really funny. Dan Oakey, longtime listener, cool dude, I refer to him. He's a funny guy. He says, I wonder if ants have a SETI program too, but we just don't get it.
I like that.
Yeah.
Excellent.
We're not getting the ant signal.
Excellent. Well, Alejandro, that is it for the news for today.
Okay, thank you.
Be sure to check out these stories and more at openminds.tv, your source for UFO-related news. I'm your Open Minds news correspondent, Jason McClellan, and you've been briefed. Back to you, Alejandro.
Thank you, Jason. You know what the ants should try? The ants should try Twitter. I got to mention my Twitter because I've been Twitter crazy lately. If you want to get my personal Twitter, it's ParanormalRPTR, Paranormal Reporter, ParanormalRPTR. And, of course, Open Minds has Twitter also. So if you're a Twitter dude, you got a couple of people to add there if you haven't already. A couple of other stories that we have on the website before we get to Mr. Mosley in 2 minutes here is, oh, look, somebody posted the link. Thank you. We have some more UFO case files revealed. So those are Michael Schrat doing his, taking some UFO sightings from popular references to UFO sightings and then making some graphics of those so you can see what they're like. So that's really cool. And we do have another story on a pub. They consider themselves Crop Circle headquarters, and they developed an alien abduction ale. They also have a crappie ale about crop circles. So essentially, they tell people when you're in town researching crop circles, you know, and you're out all night or you're out in the fields checking them out, to come have a brew at their pub. So their site is really funny, and I have a story all about that. It's kind of cool, and it makes you think, wow. How awesome would that be to go visit and see some crop circles and then go hang out at this pub? And funny enough, I recognized a picture of it because it was they shot there a TV show called Inspector Morse on PBS, which I had watched. So it was kind of funny when I saw that it was someplace I recognized. Anyway, check out this story, and hopefully one day we'll all be able to check out some crop circles at the pub out there, the Barge Inn. Is what it's called. But our interview, without further interruption, let's get to James Mosley, because it's kind of a long interview and I'm really excited about having this interview with him. And let's go ahead and bring on James Mosley of Saucer Smear.
Thank you so much for being on the show again.
So, and unfortunately, yeah, we had a did this interview. We had a glitch, so we're doing it a second time. But thank you so much. We've got James Mosley on the phone who does the saucer smear. And you have been in ufology essentially since the get-go, since 1947 when kind of the modern age of ufology began.
Well, I wasn't really in it that early, but I heard about the Kenneth Arnold sighting in 1947. I was in high school at the time, and I remember reading about it, and that was when, officially at least, the modern flying saucer era began. Kenneth Arnold was a private pilot flying in the vicinity of Mount Rainier, and he saw at some distance over the mountains a group of nine gleaming objects. I'll always remember that phrase. And they were going along in a sort of a loose formation and moving quite rapidly. I can't remember all the details now, but anyway, the interesting thing is that when he landed his plane and was eventually interviewed by the press, they asked him what these objects looked like, and he said they looked like saucers skimming over water, and that's how the term saucer began. But the interesting thing was they were not what we call saucer-shaped, the familiar shape that we know about now. They were shaped more like the heel of a shoe or something. So they were acting like saucers spinning or floating over water, but they were not shaped that way. So anyway, that's how the era began. I didn't really get into it in any significant way until 1953. The era of the groups studying saucers as a group activity and the era of the UFO zines and all that kind of thing didn't begin until about 1952. So I considered that I got in about a year late, which isn't too bad.
Right. Yeah. And it's still right in the heat of it, right when things started. Now, another sighting that hit the press really big that you were around to at least see the press was the Mantell case.
Yeah, that was in, I think, February of 1948. That's what really got my attention. That was a military pilot flying. I think there were a group of three small aircraft that were more or less chasing a very large, somewhat stationary object that was at a great altitude of something like 80,000 feet, which was tremendously high in those days. And two of the three planes broke off the chase, but this Captain Mantell, can't remember his first name right now, but he was determined to get closer to the thing, so he flew higher than the others did before they broke off, and eventually he must have blanked out from lack of oxygen, because those planes at that time did not carry oxygen, and he went too high for his equipment, and whatever happened is still a matter of controversy, but it's known as a fact that his plane fell to the ground, disintegrated into many pieces over a large area, and his body was mutilated in a grotesque way, and that was all there was to him. There were, of course, the people that took the alarmist view, you might say, that he was zapped by space people and put out a commission that way, but the more likely answer and less exciting one is that he was chasing a skyhook balloon. That project was a government project that was classified at that time and was declassified later on. Well, so they never mentioned that as an explanation at the time, but certainly it would be reasonable because those things did go to a great height. And the thing that he was chasing was not, as many other UFOs have been through the years, was not moving quickly or erratically or acting strange in any way. It was just sort of sitting there. So I would personally give the nod to the Skyhook balloon theory, but that was a big deal to a lot of people. And I remember when I read that, and at that time as a kid, I believed the Zapped by Martians scenario, and I thought, my God, there really is something very strange and exciting going on here.
They're coming to get us.
Huh?
They're coming to get us.
Yeah, well, so I sort of intensified my interest in the subject after that, and I was watching the papers, I guess, for more stories about flying saucers.
Now, with the Kenneth Arnold case, I think the prevailing idea for or answer for the skeptics is that I think what reflections off of his canopy, watching the research over the years, do you think there's been a prosaic answer proposed?
Well, I never heard the answer that you just gave. I heard it's not probably as crazy as it sounds offhand, but birds. A flock of birds, it would have to have been at a different distance than what he was estimating these craft to be. But, I mean, there is some possibility there. In my view, I mean, I'm not a professional person that can classify a UFO case as being solved, unsolved, or whatever other categories there might be. But I would say the probability is that it's an unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Of which there are many. Some cases can be solved, as you very well know, and some cannot.
Now, 1948, you got really interested with the Mantell case. And what, though, prompted you to actually get active in the field in the early 50s?
Well, what happened was in 1953, I met a professional writer. His name was Ken Crepine, long forgotten now, but he was an adventure writer.
What was his name again?
Crepine, K-R-I-P-P-E-N-E.
Okay.
Have you heard of him?
No, I don't think so.
No, well, he's long gone and forgotten. He used to write for the True magazine, such as True. That was the name of a magazine that was very big at that time, and Argosy. And he was a sort of exciting sort of guy, and I met him, long story as to how I met him, but he was interested in my interest in flying saucers, and he agreed that he was a published writer, and I was still just a kid. He agreed that he would co-author a book with me on the subject of flying saucers if I basically would do all the work, which was a good deal for him, I guess. So I took that as a gung-ho sort of situation. I was out of school by then, and I had some time and money, and I had a car. So I took a trip for a period of, I'd say, 7 or 8 weeks. And I drove from where I lived near New York City all the way out to California through a southern route, through Texas and New Mexico and so on, and then out to Los Angeles, where I stayed for a few days, and then came back in a different route, and through the middle of the country more. And what I did before I started, I got file cards from the books, the early books that I had read on flying saucers, and there were several that had come out by then. I took the more interesting cases and put them on file cards with, of course, the name of the person and the address and whatever else I could think of. And my purpose was to see as many as possible of them as I made this trip. And I don't know just how many I saw, but I took detailed notes. Every night I'd type up a whole bunch of stuff when it was still fresh in my mind, as to what I had learned that day from whoever I had talked to. And there was probably about 50 people. Some were scientists. Some were pilots who had been in the papers for having seen UFOs. And some were scientists. All kinds of any kind of person that would contribute something of interest or importance to the subject. And I ended up with over 100 pages of single-spaced typewritten notes, which I still have. And the idea to write a book with this Ken Crapine never worked out. It turned out he was completely cynical about the whole thing. I went to all this trouble to get this authentic information, and it really was something that nobody else had done, and the stuff I got then is still of interest, or at least parts of it are. But anyway, that really didn't impress him, and what he wanted to do was to make up a crazy contactee sort of story as the headline thing for the book, and then just use these true stories as filler, as a background. And I can see that I would be starting my literary career as well as my ufological career, if there is such a thing, in a very negative way, and I'd have to live this down if I ever could. So I just gave up the whole idea and did nothing with Ken Crapine on this book. And I'll just end this statement by saying it took me 48 years after that before I finally got the book out. That was in 2002 when I finally met a co-author that was far more rational, and I had a lot more experience, and things fell into place, and I did get a book out by Prometheus Press in 2002.
What's the book called?
Shockingly Close to the Truth.
Okay,
Confessions of a Grave-Robbing Ufologist.
Now, did you rate Rob Graves on your tour there?
Well, you see, now, most of the grave-robbing stuff is not in the book because it's mainly about flying saucers, but it's a hard thing to explain. During the late 1950s, I did have a lot of time and money to burn, you might say, and not only was I starting as of 1954, a Flying Saucer magazine, but I was also spending about half of my time treasure hunting in Peru,
which
is quite a different thing. But my interests were sort of equally divided between the two, quite different things. And my purpose or my hope in recent years was to write the one saucer book, which I did write, and then follow it up with a book that would only be about treasure hunting, which is equally interesting to me and to a lot of other people, but a totally different subject. Well, again, to make a long story short, my co-author died. His name was Carl Flock. I'm sure you know who he is or was. And we lost our agent, our literary agent, and the book market changed, and a whole lot of things went wrong, and I just don't think that book will ever come out. But there is some references to treasure hunting in the saucer book that did come out, and I guess that's going to be about the best I can do.
It is tragic that your interviews didn't get printed back in the 50s. That would have been something pretty groundbreaking for the period of time.
Yeah, well, some of that material was, could I say it, it was dated, of course, but I mean material that would be of any interest at any time. I had interviews with George Adansky, who was the leading contactee of those early days, and with Frank Scully, who wrote Behind the Flying Saucers, which was the first widely circulated pocketbook on the subject of saucers, which came out in 1950, and I interviewed him in 1953 on that tour. One of the other people I interviewed, and I kid you not, was Harry S. Truman.
Wow.
He was no longer president. That's another interesting story. He had a little office in Independence, Missouri, where he, as an ex-president, would just go, I guess, and do correspondence or whatever he might have done there. And I called him, I think, on a Friday or Saturday, and he answered the phone himself. And I made a sort of an appointment to see him on Monday. It wasn't a precise time. He just said, well, I'll be here. You can come by Monday morning. And I did. And he probably had somebody else that he was talking to in another room at the time I came to the door. And he seemed to be in a hurry. He didn't seem as pleasant about the whole thing as he had on the phone a couple of days earlier. But he talked to me briefly, and There were just the two of us there, as far as I know. There was no Secret Service or anything like that in those days. He was alone in the office, except for whoever else he might have been talking to. But his quotable quote, which, of course, I used in my book when I finally brought it out so many years later, was, "I've never seen a purple cow. I never hope to see one." And that was his way of saying that he did not believe in flying saucers.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was kind of cute.
Yeah, that is really funny. And it's interesting because, of course, you have so many rumors. And, in fact, someone I talked to the other day was talking as if it was well known that Truman was believed in UFOs and stuff. And I was thinking, well, I don't know that. That is known at all.
Well, that gets very controversial. Mm-hmm. You know, there is supposed to be this briefing document, first, mm-hmm. I guess, of the MJ-12 documents, which would have been Truman sort of passing on the torch of UFO knowledge to the next president. And so if we believe all that kind of thing, Truman knew about flying saucers and Eisenhower and everybody after him, but I happen to personally believe that all those documents are fraudulent in one way or another. They're not authentic at all, and I think the more likely situation is that Truman was more or less telling me the truth. I did meet Truman one time, probably about 10 years later. He came down to Clarksburg, West Virginia, one weekend when I was visiting my friend Greg Barker, who was another UFO publisher. And it just happened Truman was there campaigning for a Democrat who he supported, and he was there to back him, you might say, and make his campaign more successful. Nothing whatever to do with flying saucers. Well, again, to make a long story short, Gray Barker and I got a photographic equipment, and we crashed the press conference for Truman. I had phony press credentials, which passed in those days. Nothing like that would pass because everything is more precise, and you can't get away with it as much as you used to. But anyway, mm-hmm. We joined the real press for this press conference, and when my turn came, I spoke to Truman, and this was in a room with maybe 30 other people, so it wasn't alone like the first time, and I said, "Well, Mr. Truman, I met you several years ago. You probably wouldn't remember it, but I did ask you at that time about flying saucers, and you indicated that you did not believe in them." I didn't quote the exact words that he had used, because he might have thought I made it up. It was long after, and he might certainly not remember the exact words that he used. But anyway, he gave a facetious answer. I'm not telling this right. My turn didn't exactly come up. What happened was that Truman was getting bored with this press conference, and he was an outspoken man. He was a very interesting guy, I'm sure. And he said, "You know, everywhere I go, people ask me the same kind of questions over and over. Doesn't
that's
somebody
your opportunity.
Here, listen to this. Doesn't somebody here have an interesting question?"
Oh,
and that
and
was
you
my
had one.
Cue.
Yep.
Because my question was one that would never come up otherwise. Uh-huh. And he was delighted to hear it, and so was everybody in the room. It just, the question itself brought the house down. And Truman gave a facetious answer, which also got a laugh. And I rephrased the question a couple of times, and more laughter. And finally, I figured, well, I've done enough of this. And I said, "Well, thank you, Mr. Truman." I sat down. And that was the height of the press conference. Everybody enjoyed it.
Oh, I'm sure. That was the perfect timing.
Yeah. I was very lucky. Yeah, I've had some experiences in my life that are very interesting and unusual in a lot of different ways.
Speaking of interesting and unusual, one of the people you brought up, and I have the book right in front of me, a really old copy too, because I use it a lot for research, is the Frank Scully one, because a lot of the UFO crash stuff these days that people follow come from the book. What did you think of him and the cases he covered?
Well, there again, it's very complicated. He either believed or pretended to believe information that he had received from a man named Silas Newton. And Silas Newton also had a friend and partner named, I think it was Leo Gebauer.
Right.
Very close to that. And it turned out, as a different topic, I suppose, these two men were rather fraudulently promoting oil exploration. In other words, they were getting money from people under false pretenses. But somewhere along the way, they also got involved in the flying saucer myth or whatever. And they had a story that they had given to Scully about a flying saucer crash in 1948 in or near the town of Aztec, New Mexico. Now, that is not the Roswell crash, and that's interesting. Mm-hmm. The crash in Aztec, by all accounts, and there is one serious fellow who just in recent years has been trying to dredge up information to prove it really happened, but in the opinion of most serious researchers, that just was made up out of whole cloth by Scully and his friend. So it's interesting that 1 year previous to that was the supposed crash at Roswell, 1947, and the Roswell crash, if it did occur as an interplanetary event, occurred just a couple of weeks after the Arnold saucer. So the public was all excited at that time, and that might have contributed to the fact that people ended up thinking that that was a crash of something from another planet. But anyway, Scully was the proponent of these stories. I think the only one mentioned by name as to the location was Aztec. But he also referred to a couple of others, one of which might have been Roswell, but it wasn't named. And so this was a sensational book by all means, and it sold very well in pocketbook. And Scully had been a writer for gossip about the movie business and so forth. He had a column in Variety, which was the, I think it still is, the weekly newspaper of all kinds of showbiz news. So he was in that type of work and was well known for that, but he had never had anything to do with anything like saucers. So it got him into a new type of enterprise and got him quite a lot of fame and I suppose quite a lot of money. Well, anyway, I interviewed him and I didn't get a very good feeling that he was terribly serious about all that, and I also interviewed Silas Newton, and that also was interesting, because Silas Newton was from Colorado, and I think he lived in Denver, and by this time, he had been indicted for fraud on this oil type of controversy that I mentioned a moment ago, mm-hmm. nothing to do with flying saucers. But the day that it was just a coincidence, but the day that I got to Denver on my way back from California was just the very same day that the headline in the Denver newspaper, and actually was the banner headline, this man had been indicted for oil fraud, or however the wording was. In other words, it was just the
wow.
worst or the best day to find
right.
him. And he was in the phone book, and I found his name, and I figured, well, you know, this kind of thing, he's going to be very unhappy and certainly wouldn't want to see me. But he was very nice about it. He said, yeah, well, you know, this will get my mind off this a newspaper story that you've been reading, and I'd be very glad to talk to you about flying saucers. So I went out that evening and spent a few hours with him, and he told me all of his stories, but I certainly didn't take him terribly serious either, because after all, if he was fraudulent in the oil business, why not assume that he might also have been the same way in the saucer business?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, that's really interesting. Now, and then the other person you said you interviewed, which is, of course, a big chapter in this area in the 50s, is George Adamski.
Yeah.
Who you didn't get a good feeling about.
Well, Adamski was a different kind of person. He was likable. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that might have been one of the good things about him. I saw him, he lived, I can't think of the name of it now, but in a rural area, you might say, of Southern California. And I don't remember now if I made an appointment or anything like that, but I knew somehow that he lived in a little trailer or something behind this restaurant, which was on the road up to Mount Palomar, which was amusing because Adamski called himself Professor Adamski, and a lot of people got confused. They thought he worked at the observatory up at the top of the mountain, when he had absolutely nothing to do with that at all. Anyway, he was known that he would sort of hold court at this restaurant every afternoon, and I went and interviewed him. I had a bunch of questions, of course, written out before I got there, and he was very pleasant and very kind and patient answering these questions. I'm sure he'd been asked all of it before. But for a whole bunch of long-winded reasons, his story just didn't hold true. The main story that I was involved with talking to him about was the story that occurred in his first book, which was his meeting on the desert somewhere else near there in Southern California, in which he and a group of six witnesses drove out to a given point and parked, I guess it was a mile or two away, and saw supposedly a scout ship, a small flying saucer, land on the desert, and a being came out, a humanoid-looking being. Well, Adamski left the other six people behind at the parking lot or whatever and walked alone on the desert to go and have a private meeting with this spaceman whose name I believe was Ashtar. And he was just a very handsome, human-looking person. I guess if you met him on the street, you wouldn't know he was a spaceman. And Adamski got all kinds of information about Venus, which was the home planet of this Ashtar, and all kinds of messages of sweetness and light and ban the bomb and save the environment and learn to get along with each other and all that kind of thing. No specific information that we couldn't think of on our own, but still very interesting. And that first book of Adamski sold very, very well. I met Adamski two or three times after that, but I had no reason to believe his story. And, of course, we know through scientific research that came about, I guess, years after that, that the story had to be totally absurd because the surface temperature of Venus is, I believe, 700 degrees.
Kind of warm.
And that makes it hard for an ordinary human to live there.
It's
warm.
It's difficult enough here in Arizona.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that in itself made the story very unlikely. I think I remember something about after the information came out about the surface temperature of Venus, Adamski claimed that it was Venus Etheria. You see, that is the etheric double somehow of the planet Venus. And, of course, Venus Etheria is a beautiful planet, sort of like ours, and certainly not anything like Venus itself. So So, you know, the story held up. It didn't matter.
Now, in the 50s, Adamski, and a lot of people have kind of forgotten this, it's kind of a forgotten chapter, I think, he wasn't the only contactee. There were a lot of people claiming to be speaking to spacemen.
Yeah, well, there was Truman Bethram, Orfeo Angelucci, Daniel Fry, and several others. Gabriel Green was one of my favorites. I can't really remember all of their stories, but I met all of those and others because I didn't do this on my first trip out to California in 1953, but through the years I went at least two or three times to these annual conventions that they had on the desert, and they were run by another contactee whose name was George Van Tassel, and Van Tassel lived with his wife out on the desert, and he wanted attention, I guess. He had a little newsletter that he put out, but once a year he hosted a giant outdoor convention. It was near a natural thing called Giant Rock, which was an actual huge rock on the desert. I don't know how it got there. There's nothing else like it nearby, but certainly a landmark. And people would come out by the thousands to enjoy the desert. And he built a platform on top of the rock with steps going up to it and a microphone and all. And he would have people speak to the masses from Giant Rock itself. And it was quite a interesting scenario. And Van Tassel was another guy I liked. He was very kind and gentle, and he knew very well from my reputation, because by that time I was already putting out my saucer magazine, Saucer News, which took a partially skeptical view, or at least about the contactees. But he was very nice to me and let me speak from the rock also. And I think I didn't speak too long. I didn't have that much to say to a crowd of this sort. But anything like that was very genial on the part of Van Tassel. He also built, supposedly from plans or knowledge given to him by the space people, he built a thing called the Integratron. I'm just struggling to remember these things after all these years. The Integratron was a circular building. It was a dome. It looked like an astronomical observatory of some sort. And it was never finished, really. The dome was finished, but there was supposed to be some equipment, some machinery inside it that would sort of rejuvenate people, make them feel younger and maybe even look younger. It didn't give you eternal life, but it did certain very good things for you through some kind of vibrations that came from these machines. Well, the money, I think, the information might have come, but the money didn't, to complete all these machines that were supposed to go inside the Integratron. So it became a point of interest, of course, for tourists anyhow. It was usually locked up. One time, I forget how, but I was with somebody that had a key, and I did get inside, and it was just a big building. I forget what the diameter was, maybe 50 or 70 feet, and just empty. but it was an interesting experience to see the inside of the thing. Well, finally, Van Tassel died. He kept these conventions going through the 50s and 60s, and then died sometime in the 70s. He never did finish the Integratron, but it's still there. It's passed through different hands over the years, and I forget what it's been being used for right now, but it's always had some New Age connotation all through these years.
Yeah, I think people do tours, and they talk about Van Tassel, and they also do meditations and things like that.
Yeah. Well, they've had marriages there, and they've had meditations there. And
yeah.
Actually, I'd forgotten It may have died out now, but just in very recent years, as recently as a year or two ago, they started having annual conventions at the Integratron.
Hmm.
But they didn't catch on. What is his name? Paul Kimball. You know who he is. Out there a couple of years ago, I guess he spoke there. There was only about 50 people, which was a very disappointing crowd. And I don't remember if that was the last one or whether they went on with it. But it didn't catch on for some reason. I don't know.
It's amazing that they were able to get thousands of people in the middle of the desert in the summer, you know, in the heat and everything. And it looks like from the pictures, it's not like people had much cover out there.
Well, some did and some didn't. People came in their cars and trailers and so forth. I mean, you know, you could bring anything that you wanted. There was no accommodations actually there. There was, I think the nearest real town was 29 Palms, which was about 20 miles away, and there were a few motels there. I stayed there at least once, I think. I never slept actually out on the desert.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a thrill. It was something interesting and amusing and different. And I might add that there were some drugs involved in those days. And,
now, do you, out of all those people claiming to speak to extraterrestrials, do you believe any of them? People like Van Tassel, who you said seemed like a nice, genuine person?
Well, you know, I was reading something, I guess, by Nick Redfern just the other day. It might have been somebody else, you know.
He wrote about it recently.
The contactees are getting like a second look, and now the whole study of ufology, I think, is getting more complicated, and I'm glad that it is, because it's not just spacemen from another planet anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There are other theories involved. But people are saying maybe these contactees did have experiences of some kind, or at least some of them did. Might have been not physical, but metaphysical, or whatever you want to call it. And so they may have had some truth and some validity in what they were doing, and that they shouldn't be written off completely. And I think there's something to that, and I think it's worth exploring. I don't know how we could ever get to the bottom of it, but it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Now, you kind of, that leads to your overall views, and I like this quote. I mentioned it before because it kind of is Jerome Clark's take on your views. That you've entertained just about every view possible to hold about UFOs without ever managing to say anything especially interesting or memorable about any of them. And, of course, at the time, he didn't mean that to be a compliment.
No, he didn't. Are you reciting that from memory, or do you have the actual quote?
No, actually, I have the quote.
Did he say interesting or memorable? Is that what he said?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Didn't manage to say anything especially interesting or memorable.
Well, Jerry Clark has a sharp tongue and a sharp pen, and I won't begrudge him that particular remark, because there's a lot of truth in it. There was a period of time I said that I believed that the saucers were all Earth made by our government and other governments, and then I went interplanetary. And then I went specifically to the idea that they come from Mars, because I forget just what it was at that time. It seemed Mars was terribly likely to have intelligent life.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, it may still turn out to have some kind of life, even if it's just microbes. And people still were influenced by the canals on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Which had been discovered by, what's his name, Percival Lowell, back around the turn of the century. And you can see pictures of what is seen through the telescope, and there are these markings that look very much like straight lines. But the trouble is, as we got better telescopes later on, and you can see that that's just an optical illusion. There are no straight lines on Mars, but if you think that there are, and if you tie that in with the a big wave of sightings of little men landing on this planet, especially in Europe and South America in the early 1950s. If you put all that together, you can start believing in Martians. And so I got onto that, and then I guess back to the general interplanetary feeling of it. Now, in the last 15 or 20 years, at least I'm interdimensional, or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's something far more complex than simple spaceships coming from physical planets far away in the universe. Now, Stanton Friedman insists that that is the case, and I suppose theoretically it could be. I mean, there's no limit to the amount of advancement that some other civilization might have, and these tremendous distances might be no problem for them at all. But there are a lot of reasons to think that that probably isn't the answer, and it's a long story here, but I think you and I talked about it last
mm-hmm.
time. The behavior of the saucers themselves makes you feel immediately that this is not the way intelligent creatures from somewhere else would behave. They, among other things, they lie. I mean, not only did the contactees learn somewhat different messages from each space person that they met, but there have been other instances of creatures, or little men or whatever, saying things in more recent years, which have also not been true. And the whole methodology of what they do, they just don't have any coherent pattern to it. But I think the most telling thing, and there's no explanation for this at all, when you get down to the UFO cases that probably are genuine and weed out all the ones that are errors or hoaxes or whatever else might be wrong, when you get just to the genuine ones, and especially the ones where there's enough detail where you can tell exactly what was seen, all these things look different.
Mm-hmm.
There's no two that are exactly alike. Now, you know, to take a simple analogy, I mean, with automobiles, if you're seeing automobiles from a distance, or you're on another planet trying to figure out what an automobile is, and you're looking at these things, well, they're all slightly different, but they are basically, in most ways, almost the same, and you can reach a conclusion. There is something here. It's an automobile, and it looks approximately like this, this, and this, and that's what it will always look like.
Mm-hmm.
But that isn't the way with the saucers. They are as if deliberately different. There is no coherent pattern. The light patterns are different. The shapes are different. When creatures come out, they always look different. They don't come out looking like idealized humans like they did in the contactee days. Now they either look like these grays who are not particularly handsome, or they're little men that's gone out of style now, but in the 50s that was very big. Little men that look just about like us, I guess dwarfs. We don't see them much anymore, and there's no consistency in the way they look, in the messages, or the way the craft looks. So
somebody is playing
with us, you see. That's what I think it is.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to mention. I think that a lot of conventional scientists has a problem with this field, and it's difficult to study. And a lot of researchers get frustrated that it's so enigmatic, and I get the feeling, like you mentioned, it's enigmatic by design.
Yes, I think that is the pattern, that there is no pattern. There's one thing I hadn't thought of when I talked to you the other time, and that is you're familiar with the Project Blue Book in the 50s. That was the program that the Air Force had to study UFO cases and try to figure out what they were. Well, there was Project Blue Book report, I guess, number 1 through 12. And it's a different story, but I was able to get to the Pentagon one time and actually see those Blue Book volumes, which no other researcher, I don't think, ever was able to do. It was, again, just blind luck on my part, but after 12, for some reason, they skipped 13, although there are rumors that there was a 13 that was totally different from any of the others, but I think that's more garbage. But that's, again, another story. There was a 14, which was supposed to be a recap of the other 12. And what they did, they actually tried. They went to a statistician outfit, I forget the name of it, a well-known military outfit, that would crunch the numbers, so to speak, and try to get to the bottom of the whole thing. Well, for one thing, they found that the number of unknowns was a lot larger than the Air Force had ever admitted, and that was one thing that was very interesting and important. But another thing was, and I just happened to think about this a couple of days ago for the first time in years, the best thing that they did in this project, Blue Book Report 14, which was quite large and had all kinds of statistics in it, but what they did, they took the six cases that had the most detail and tried to, well, first they put in a drawing of each of the six, and then the purpose was to see if they looked like each other, and all six looked completely different. And that's where that idea came up, I think, the first time, that they are all different. And furthermore, scientists seeing that, or anyone else that goes by all old-fashioned logic, would say, well, it's nonsense, because if it was real, they'd all tend to look alike, as in the analogy of the automobile. So that's where it became obvious that this was a phenomenon that was not subject to normal interpretation.
Yeah. You know, along those lines, the scientific inquiry, which kind of came to those sorts of conclusions, was the hunt for the Skinwalkers, a ranch in Utah by Bigelow's group, NID. And I talked to Combe Kelleher. And the Skinwalker, I kind of got that idea right when I saw the title, because although the Skinwalker is, you know, this kind of witch legend in Native American history, I've always thought it akin to the trickster, because, you know, I've got a background in Native American history, and I've always been interested in that idea. And Combe, they kind of said they felt that way, that with all their science, with all their technology and their resources, this phenomena seemed to have an intelligence that was always one step ahead of them, where they really couldn't figure anything out.
Yeah, there was a book on that by George Knapp and somebody else, co-authored it, can't remember.
Combe Kelleher, the lead scientist with NID.
Oh, yeah, I wish I had read that, because that must be very interesting. And as you say, I think for a period of several months, a group of real scientists with real equipment. This was all paid for by Bigelow, right? Bigelow bought the ranch, and because it was haunted, so to speak, and spent his money to send these people out on a scientific expedition. And actually, my understanding is they were never actually able to prove anything, as you say.
Right.
The proof always escapes them, as if something was working intelligently against them, so that there would be no proof. And that may be very true in the UFO field also, in which case we have extremely little chance of ever solving this in the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. Now, the enigmatic nature, in some cases, gets people really frustrated. Another thing that causes a lot of frustration is a lot of the infighting and the egos. And I was wondering, you know, which was it, or was it a combination, or was it either of these that kind of had you evolved in going to create Saucer Smear, which is kind of more humor and gossip?
Well, originally, beginning in 1954, I had a more conventional, you might say, UFO magazine called Saucer News, and I would have articles by contributors, people that were known in the field. I would try to keep up with the latest sightings, which was hard to do because in the 50s, as I told you, I was in Peru treasure hunting half the time. So I don't know myself how I managed to keep this magazine going at the same time I was out of the country. I mean, I'd be out of the country a month or two and then back a month or two, but I kept both of these things going at the same time. But anyway, when I reached the mid-1970s, for whatever reason, I just got tired of doing it that way. And I figured, well, I want to go on with this, but from here on, it's just going to be me, whatever I want to write. And I'm not going to try to keep up with sightings, and I'm not going to have articles by other experts. I'm just going to do anything that I want and be interesting, hopefully, and humorous and cynical and whatever I care to be. And by that time, I had reached, I think, my present belief that a 3D saucers from another planet was not the answer, and I went on speculating about the other possible answers. So that's how Saucer Smear began, and I think it's improved over the years, but the mailing list has declined because of a lot of factors, one of them, of course, being the Internet. Since I'm not on the net and it's only a print magazine, it's kind of passé to that extent, and will go its way into history, I suppose, before too long. But anyway, yeah, that's how Saucer News began. Saucer Smear, rather.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it is a lot of fun, and like I like to call it kind of a guilty pleasure, but because I love to read it every time, and your humor is really funny. And plus, I guess it's kind of an insider thing because you got to know who these researchers are, and then the better you know them, the more humorous.
Well, that's right. I mean, if somebody tries to read this that has no background of knowing who the people are that I'm talking about, I mean, what fun is it to read an expose of a person you've never heard of to begin with? these days, kind of off the subject, but I'm still interested in reading things like the National Enquirer, and there's two others that go with it, the same kind of scandal sheets. I can't remember the name of them right now. But, you know, I go through them quite quickly. I read the exposés on the people I've heard of and I'm interested in, and most of the actors and actresses that they are exposing for fighting with their wife or taking drugs or whatever they're doing wrong, I mean, I skip it because I don't know who it is.
Right.
Why do I care what somebody's doing if I don't know who they are to begin with?
Yeah.
So Saucer Smear is just for the people that are in the know, I guess, and interested in that aspect of what's going on in the saucer field. I also, and I know that your magazine Open Minds does the same thing, I also rehash some of the classic cases from the past, because another thing that I think we talked about last time, beginning in about 1980, and for whatever reason, I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows, but the close-up cases that have enough proof or near proof and detail to make you say, well, something certainly had to have happened here. It can't be just lights in the sky or somebody making a mistake. Those kinds of cases just don't seem to happen anymore for whatever reason. And so it's interesting to go back over some of the well-known cases of the past and rehash them and try to continue to figure out what they really might be.
Well, and I think what, for better or worse, since the media doesn't pay much attention to this field, is that a lot of people don't know about those old cases. They get and it was the same for me when I got involved, but people get involved with and interested in the field, and they start to read books and everything, and then they know what happens from when they got involved onwards, but they don't know a lot about the history. And so I found rehashing a lot of those old cases is very eye-opening for people.
Yeah, well, you do a lot of that in Open Minds, I know.
Yeah.
And, golly, I have enjoyed that aspect of your magazine, I think,
more than any other,
because there are some of those old cases that are better known than others, and even the ones that you've heard of, you're going to forget the details. And it's very interesting to reread those things.
Yeah. Well, and like you've said, there's been waves. You talked about how and the sightings in the 50s, and there were lots of landings where entities were seen, and then you have the 70s, which was a lot of sightings, and then it morphed, and like you said, there's a kind of not as many of these physical type of landings and stuff with these evidence, and then it morphed into the abduction thing, so it does change.
Well, yeah, I remember, I'm trying to remember if it was 52 or 54, but there was one summer where there were just dozens of these cases,
yeah,
especially from France. And they, as usual, the craft all looked different, and the behavior of the occupants was different. But there was some consistency, and these were little creatures that looked, I guess, like dwarfs or midgets. And we don't get that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just very peculiar how these things do go in waves for reasons that are not explained by anybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like we were able to cover a lot more last time. Maybe that just means I'll have to have you on again. But we're pretty much out of time. So do you want to give people the address, though? Because people can subscribe or get on the list. I think you call them non-subscribers.
Yeah.
Well,
the reason I call them non-subscribers is because I've found it convenient not to set a price. If
mm-hmm.
I set a price, then those that want to will send that amount, and certainly no more than that amount. But if I don't set a price, there are a few people who will send far more than the set price, you see. So, in other words, more or less, I think I come out ahead by not setting a price. So, you send what you want, but it better be generous. That's all I can say. And it's Saucer Smear, just two words, Saucer, S-M-E-A-R, P.O. Box 1709, Key West, two words, Key West, Florida, 33041. And it would be interesting if they mentioned that they heard me on this show, because I'll be honest with you, I've been on a number of these internet shows, and I don't get a whole lot of response, but
mm-hmm.
it'll be interesting to see what happens.
And this year marks 30 years you've been doing it? Is that correct?
Doing what, a Saucer Smear?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I think I changed it from Saucer News to Saucer Smear, I think, in 1976.
Mm.
So that's more, let's see, 86, 96, 35 years about, yeah.
Okay, yep. All right, well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me back, and I'm sorry about what happened last time, and we'll see where we go from here, huh?
Great to have him on. Remember, that address is P.O. Box 1709, Key West, Florida, 33041. Remember to tell him you heard about him on Open Minds Radio. And he was kidding, of course, about the donation having to be generous. That would be nice, but he takes practically anything. So, and it is a funny, very, very, he's got a great sense of humor. I hear he was more serious talking ufology, but his Saucer Smear is very funny. Next week, we have Don Schmidt. He's actually going to be one of the speakers at the Kingman Conference we talked about earlier, and so we'll talk to him about that. But he is the preeminent Roswell, well, one of the main Roswell researchers, so we'll talk to him a bit about a great article he has in our magazine coming out in just a couple of weeks, which is about Roswell and all of the deathbed confessions and the witnesses who say they saw a little creature that survived the crash. So he also worked for J. Allen Hynek, and he's also got an illustrious UFO career. So next week, Don Schmidt, thanks for listening to Open Minds Radio. Don't forget to visit openminds.tv for more UFO news. We'll talk to you next week.